Okay, here, Absalom's rebellion. Remember again the three different responses to the discipline of the Lord that we talked about in the last session from Hebrews 12:5. Three responses. It says, when you're disciplined by the Lord, don't take it lightly, number one. Number two, it says, don't lose heart. Don't be totally overwhelmed by it either. But number three, it says, endure it. And the first two responses is what happens often. And David is a picture of the third response. That's why we have seven chapters dedicated to his discipline, because we're watching a godly person with a willing spirit endure discipline with humility in a right way. That's the message of these seven chapters, is the how to endure discipline in a right way. The first one, Hebrews 12:5, is to take it lightly, to take discipline lightly. That's the person that thinks all the things happening is just the devil. They say, and it's persecution or the devil. Well, they're persecuting me, it's just the devil attacking. They never can see God's hand, even though the devil is always there. The devil is God's devil. God owns the devil. God controls or puts boundaries on the devil. Let's say it that way. The devil has a limited leash on what he can do. He cannot vent his rage unchecked. He has measured liberties. And the Lord will not let the devil run with havoc in a person's life. He's got a certain measured leash that he can work his rage against individuals. And it's according to God's wisdom. And some of the devil's rage we can stop through faith and obedience. And some of it the Lord uses to discipline us. But some people take the discipline of the Lord lightly. When the Lord's correcting them, I gave the example of my own life in the last session we had, where there was times where I thought it was just the devil. And it was the devil working and lying and manipulating through people. But the Lord was still dealing with my lack of wisdom, my pride, my self-will. And so it's easy to take the discipline of the Lord lightly and write it off as just a hard time of persecution. And it really is God putting his hand on us, disciplining us. The second response is also negative. That's to take it too hard. That's to lose heart. These people give up. They say, forget it then. I'm not even going to walk with God then. I'm not going to do the work of the Lord. If that's how God treats me, there's anger and disappointment towards God in a great amount there. They just say, forget it. You know, if that's what the Lord's going to do, they really lose heart and they give up. And that's as easy as taking it lightly. But the third one in Hebrews 12:5 is to endure it. And I have done all three of them. I've taken it lightly sometimes. I've had times when I've really been tempted to give up. Now, praise God, by the grace of God, it doesn't last very long. But I've known what it means to say, well, God, if that's how you're going to treat the people that serve you, I don't even want to do this. I don't mean I don't want to walk with you, but I don't want to lead. I don't want to do ministry. I don't want to mess with other broken, weak people, etc. Like, that's what ministry is all about, right? And David is a tremendous example. I mean, the more I read this, I'm overwhelmed at his ability to endure with humility and a broken heart. It's because right through here, the key to this passage is David's knowledge he's under discipline. That's why he allows a number of things to go. That's why he allows Shimei to curse him in chapter 16. And, you know, and Abishai, Joab's brother, one of those sons of Zeruiah, says, let me cut the guy's head off. And David says, shut up. He goes, the Lord's in this. He goes, this is part of the discipline I'm under. He didn't say it just that way, but that's the essence of it. And so I look at him and I go, this is powerful. This is a powerful example of stability and endurance with humility under a hard season of discipline. David knew it's coming. Chapter 12, so we looked at last session, verse 10 to 12, the prophet Nathan, when he told him about his sin, he said, you will come under discipline. It will touch your family and the whole nation will watch it. And he said, the sword will never ever leave your family. You will always have turmoil in your house to the very end. And it was to the very, very end. Adonijah, his eldest living son, wanted to usurp Solomon on David's deathbed. And then Solomon ended up putting him to death. David saw the sword to the very last moment of his life in his family. And that was his discipline for having such a high exalted position of favor and being so presumptuous with the favor God had given him. Okay, so David is pictured here in chapter 15 and 16 as the penitent soul, as the penitent soul, the humble soul, the repentant soul, who is embracing the wisdom of God and his divine discipline. That's what he's pictured as here. The penitent soul who's embracing God's justice and wisdom. He says, I deserve it. He's not saying I deserve to go to hell. He's not like in a wrong relationship with God. He knows this God's mercy has forgiven him. He goes, I deserve and need this season of discipline in my life. So we see him with godly sorrow before God instead of striving and scheming to get out of the discipline. Because when we're under discipline and we know it's the Lord, we are literally resisting God by scheming and striving to get out of it. It's better to endure it, get through it. It will lift. God's rod will lift. And the season of blessing will come. Just endure it. And there isn't a person in this room or in the body of Christ on the earth who will not go through seasons of discipline if God loves you. Or rather, since God loves you. It says in Hebrews 12, all the children God loves, they will have seasons of discipline. You've talked to some people, they've been in the Lord 20 years, and you say, well, when were the seasons of discipline? And they look back and they can't think of one that they actually recognized. And I go, hello. You mean you've been in the Lord 20 years and you can't recognize one season of discipline in your life? Well, no. I mean, it's been hard a few times. We need a new understanding of our Father's rod. I can recognize two or three. I've probably been under seven or eight. But I know for sure two or three that was the Lord saying, I love you. I'm going to deal with the pride and the self-will of your heart. And that's why I'm going to let some of this happen. The devil's working. I'm using other people's sinfulness. But I am dealing with you because I really care about you. So just yield to it. Now, the interesting thing in this season of discipline is that there are the touches of divine comfort. I mean, that's a beautiful thing that you see this blow that comes against David, this negative, but in the midst of it, and all the darkness and gloom, there's rays of light. There's touches of kindness of God with his provision straight through it. And I like that part about God, that in the midst of sorrow, there is joy. Even in the season of discipline, we can find God and have some times of joy in it. There can be sorrow in the joy in the midst of the sorrow. There can be some victory even in the midst of this season that seems like defeat. It seems like a bummer season. There can be some breakthroughs even. So don't ever write a season off as all negative, because in the midst of them, as we see in David, there's these tremendous provisions of God that come through him and bless him in the midst of it. Okay. Roman numeral 1, Absalom's treason against David. Remember, this is the fulfillment of chapter 12, verse 10 to 12, where the Nathan said, in your own family, there will be the sword and there will be strife. After this, it happened that Absalom provided himself with chariots and horses and 50 men to run before him. Now, the after this means chapter 14, 33, the last verse. After David kissed Absalom and restored him to the king's court. Remember, Absalom's been in the city, I think, now 2 years. In Jerusalem, restored, but he lives out, you know, on a farm all by himself somewhere doing his own business, and David won't let him into the court system. He won't let him into the king's court with all the other sons. Of course, he killed one of the sons, and the whole nation is watching him. But David now bows to the pressure from Joab, as we found out in chapter 14, which is negative. This is wrong. But David is actually allowing Absalom to get in the position to actually fulfill the word of God of discipline against David. I mean, David's opening the door to the very man that's going to come and release the discipline of God upon him. He kisses him in 14:33 and restores him to the place of honor in the court where he can move, manipulate, and start getting things in order, because he couldn't do that without being restored to the court. That's why he wanted to be with David. He goes, I want to see my father's face. Everyone goes, oh, isn't that sweet? Well, he wants to kill his father. He has a spirit of revenge. He doesn't care about his father. What he means is, I want to get next to the court system. I want to get on in a position of power. So that's what it means by after this. It happened that Absalom provided himself with chariots and horses and 50 men to run. Now, the other sons of David had mules that they rode on. We find in chapter 13, verse 19. They rode mules. So the horses and chariots, he's giving this persona of royalty and grandeur. That's what's going on right here. He is positioning himself, and David should have, and probably, I mean, he had to have seen what was going on. This was so overt that he got chariots and horses and 50 men to run before him. That means everywhere he went, he had this entourage, make way, Absalom's coming with his horses and chariots. I mean, that's a little bit heavy, you know. Could you imagine the next person coming in, you know, with chariots and horses and da-da-da-da, the royal entourage, you know, and they come walking in, and so he's making a statement of prominence. He's not walking around in brokenness at all in gratitude for being restored to his father's court. Now, Absalom would rise up early and stand beside the way to the gate. So he'd get up early, He'd stand by the way of the gate. That's where the authority was at the gate. That's where the court system operated, by the gate, where the elders sat, and that's where the cases were tried. So he'd get up early before everyone else. He'd get to the gate because he was doing his political stuff. And so what he was doing was winning the hearts of Israel, for those of you that have read this. So Absalom would rise early and stand by the way of the gate. So it was whenever anyone who had a lawsuit came to the king for a decision, Absalom would get there first. And he would say, "What city are you from?" He would say, "Your servant is from such and such a tribe city." He'd interview him, probably find out which people had prominence and power and wealth, and those were the ones he was going to win. I mean, this guy is insidious. He is really a wicked dude. I mean, when you read the whole story, there are a few people in the Bible as wicked as Absalom is. So, but he's the most handsome man in Israel. And all of Israel, lots of Israel adores him because of his outward beauty and his charm and charisma. Verse 3, Absalom would say to him, "Look, your case is good and it's right, but there is no deputy of the king to hear you." So he would always tell the people they were right, whether they were or were not. He would lie to them. He would flatter them. He says, "Oh, yes, if I was king, I would rule in your favor." So he's lying and flattering everyone. That's how the Absalom spirit works. And he's standing between the king, the leadership, and the people, and he's undermining the leadership of the nation constantly. He's always asking questions that cause the people to undermine who David is and David's credibility. And so he stands before them, and he says in verse 4, "Oh, that I were made judge in the land, and everybody who had a lawsuit or case would come to me, then I would give him justice." This is a total sham. You can't give justice to everybody. Sooner or later, and he's going to talk to Bill over here, and he's going to say, "You're right," and then Tom's going to be against Bill, and he's going to have to tell Tom he's right too. So somewhere the thing's going to collide. But in verse 3, he said, "There's no deputy of the king to hear you." He goes, "There's no one that really cares like I care." So he sits at the gate. It says in verse 5 that everyone that came near to him to bow down to him, because he's in this position at the court, he would put his hand out, take him, and kiss him. He would kiss all their hands to show personal affection. That's a sign of personal affection. But in this case, he had no regard for them whatsoever. It was a false, he was feigning affection and honor and love to them. That's what was going on here. So he's standing before the people, and I've heard teachings about this over the years, so those of you that are preachers, present or in the future, there's a whole teaching about the Absalom spirit. He's the person that gets to the gate there first. He undermines the king's authority. He says, "If there's no deputy, nobody cares like I care. I'm the only one that can really do it for you. You're right." And he kisses their hand, shows them a lot of affection. And it says in verse 6, he stole the hearts of the men of Israel away from David. That's what he's doing. And that's what Absalom always does. He stands at the door and kisses the hand and does that. And it says that, verse 6, "In this manner Absalom acted towards all of Israel who came to the king for judgment." Now, he did this for 4 years. For 4 years. This is not a small... I mean, he's working hard. He's waiting till the time is right before he makes his move. Now, I want to say again, like we said in the last session, sin has weakened David. I don't just mean his heart. I mean, before God, I don't even mean in that way in this case, though sin does weaken your heart before God. It hardens us and blinds us. But David doesn't have the ability to stand his ground. He cannot confront sin in the same way because he's committed such sin. And everybody knows a person that's been under a public discipline has such a difficult time executing discipline on other people unless they've got a bitter spirit. And so it's really a difficult thing. It's like David's been hamstrung in his ability to bring justice, especially to his family. He can't do it to Joab. I've seen men that have been under a public discipline for instance, immorality. I'm thinking of a few men I know now that were restored to ministry. They could never deal severely with immorality because they thought everybody was saying, "How dare you? You hypocrite." And so this really compromised him. This is part of one of the worst fruit of David's sin is the next 30 years of ruling with a limp because of that sin, because the people would call him a hypocrite if he dealt strong with the sin. And so he has weeds growing in his garden everywhere. That's the long fruit of a leader who gets into some kind of major scandalous compromise and the Lord reveals it publicly. It's just so hard to recover a real sharpness and a clarity in their leadership. Sin has weakened David's ability to deal with sin in the nation. And so you say, well, maybe he should have got out of there. I doubt it. It seems like the Lord wanted him there. But it's just a terrible situation. It's just the consequences of sin. Now, David should have seen Absalom at the court. All of Israel was being won by Absalom, kissing the hand. I mean, surely David knew what was going on. He's got these chariots, these men running, announcing his grandiose spirit. Something's not right here. And David just, he doesn't yield to it. Part of it, I'm assuming, is because of his submission to divine discipline. That he's saying, I know what's going on, Absalom. You're not tricking me, but I have to submit to this. Or it's a mixture of that plus his own inability to deal with his family in the right way. Verse 7. Now it came to pass that after 40 years, how many of your Bible say 40 years? How many of you say 4 years? Okay, half say 40, half say 4. Because in the manuscripts, when they looked at them, and then they leave a note in most Bibles in the margin, they're not sure if it's 4 or 40. Because of how the manuscripts, because there's like 20 different manuscripts, ancient manuscripts, and some of them do disagree. They have the 4 or, and some have the 4. Oh, I believe it's 4. That's what he's talking. That's the only thing it could be. I mean, he couldn't have waited 40 years. David had been, 130 or something. So to me, it seems, if it says 40 in the margin, it says or 4, because they're just telling you they're not positive, but to me, it seems pretty clear it's 4. It came to pass that after 4 years that Absalom said to the king, please let me go to Hebron and pay the vow which I made to the Lord. For your servant took a vow while I was at Geshur at Syria, remember when he went into exile for 3 years, saying, if the Lord indeed brings me back to Jerusalem, then I will serve the Lord. So David's kind of excited about this. He's thinking, wow, my son Absalom, who has the Gentile mother, the heathen mother, and his king is the king of Geshur. And David, I think, is excited that his son wants to serve the Lord, but he's being deceived by his son right now. His son doesn't want to serve the Lord. His son wants to take over the nation. He wants to get out of Hebron to rally his troops, which is maybe only 10, 15 miles from Jerusalem. Then he's going to come back and attack Jerusalem when his troops are rallied. He needs some breathing room. So he asked David, because he can't just leave the city. He has to get permission from the king to do that because of his place in the court. And so he said, stage is set. The time is right. He's in 4 years, he's won enough of the key people in the nation. He's been promising favors, undoubtedly, to people. He's going to make his move. Incidentally, this is 11 years from Tamar's rape that we talked about in the last session. It's 11 years. Because it was 2 years that he was angry at Amnon before he attacked him. Remember, 2 years he held it in his heart. Then he kills Amnon for raping his sister. Then 3 years he's in Geshur in exile, so that's up to 5. Then he comes back for 2 more years and he can't see David. He's in Jerusalem but not in the court, that's 7. Now 4 more years he's at the court winning, so it's 11 years. So David is now, instead of 38 or 39, David is, 38 or 39 when he committed to sin is what David committed to sin with Bathsheba when he was about 37, 38, 39. We can't be real positive. But David right now is about 60 years old right now. Amnon is about 30 years old, give or take a year or two. That's what's happening right now. David's about 60. Amnon's about 30. It's been 11 years since his younger sister was raped. He was about probably 19 at the time. She was probably 16, 11 years earlier. Yeah, what'd I say, Absalom? Yes, Absalom's about 30. Man, I'm glad. I just seen if you guys were listening. Okay, so you got the feel of it. David's about 60 years old, 60, 61 years old. So Absalom's about 30. Remember, Absalom's about 19 when he killed his brother. Okay, so the king said to him, go in peace. And he arose and went to Hebron. Now, Hebron was the place he was born, number one. So he's got a lot of friends there. Hebron, he knows the area, and he's got a lot of connections. This guy's a real connection kind of guy. I mean, he's got so much charisma and personal beauty that they're all behind him. Chapter 3, verse 2 and 3, that's where he's born. You find that in chapter 3, verse 3. And Hebron was also the place that David began to reign. Well, that's why Absalom was born there, because David was reigning for that 7-year period. Absalom was born in that early, when David reigned from age 30 to 37, that's when Absalom's born. And so he's got a lot of connections there. So David, I think his weak spot is that he knows that Absalom wants to go serve God. He's, or at least to say that. And he's thinking, wow, that's good. I've never seen that in Absalom's heart. That's great. Now, if you want to pay a vow to God, you know, if you want to go to the youth camp, I'll pay your way and everything else, you know. And when I went to the first, never mind, verse 10. And Absalom sent spies throughout all the tribes of Israel, saying, as soon as you hear the sound of the trumpet, then you shall say, Absalom reigns in Hebron. Maybe some of the people thought David had died because, you know, because there's no news of a conspiracy yet. And they're going, wow, what's that mean? We mean, no announcement. That's all? Is David still alive? Is he okay? So the trumpet is announced, and David, and it says that Absalom reigns in Hebron. So Absalom, with 200 men invited from Jerusalem, they went along innocently. They didn't even know anything. So Absalom invites 200 key leaders in the nation. You can be sure these are very prominent leaders, people of rank and stature and wealth, so that they appear to be endorsing Absalom. So Absalom's got them all there at the big banquet and the party and spending time with him, all the key people in the nation, young people probably. He blows the trumpet and says, I'm in charge, and everybody sees the 200 with him. It's total deception. The 200 don't even know they're being used. They're going like, is something going on, Absalom, that you haven't told us about? But the masses see all the key people standing at Absalom's side when this happens. Now, the reason they go to his party to start with is because they don't want to offend him, because he looks like he's the heir to the throne. You know, David's 60. They're thinking, hey, in 10 or 15 years, he's going to be the king of Israel. So, hey, Absalom, you know, if you want us there, we'll be there. So, I mean, this guy is a cunning, deceitful person. Okay, verse 12. Absalom sent for Ahithophel. Ahithophel, David's counselor from the city of where he offered sacrifices. And the conspiracy grew, for the people with Absalom continued to increase in number, because this is fulfilling the judgment of God. The reason the conspiracy grew, God wanted it to grow. Absalom completely misinterprets the momentum. Absalom's like Pharaoh. It says in Exodus 30, whatever, and it says that God raised up Pharaoh. It's in Romans 9. I'm thinking of the Romans 9 passage, quoting Exodus. God raised Pharaoh up, and Pharaoh's thinking, hey, Mom, God raised me up, most powerful man in the world, but to show the wrath of God, so that God would make him a picture of God's wrath on a man. God is raising up Absalom, and Absalom feels the momentum, but he's completely misinterpreting it. He's going to die real soon. He's going to have a premature death in his early 30s, 30, 31, 32, and he's going to be used as an instrument to train his, to discipline his father, but he doesn't know any of this. He thinks it's all about him. So he's misinterpreting. Now, Ahithophel is a very interesting man. He's one of the most powerful men in Israel's history. At that time is what I meant, Ahithophel. He is the top counselor to David, and the whole nation knows who he is. He's like the Secretary of State counseling David at war, even more powerful than Joab, the commander, the five-star general over the army. And Ahithophel has this tremendous reputation of having, like it says in chapter 16, verse 23, the counsel of the Lord. It says when he spoke, it was as though the angel of the Lord spoke. His counsel was so consistently excellent and beyond all the counsel of all of other, you know, the cabinet around David, that he's got a reputation across the nation of being a man of tremendous counsel and understanding. So when Ahithophel was at Absalom's side, this was a powerful statement. The nation goes, wow. I mean, in our world, I would think of somebody like a Paul Cain. I mean, a person who hears the word of the Lord, he goes over and says, I'm with this thing over here. People say, well, gee, I mean, Paul Cain seems to be, you know, hear from God pretty clear. Kind of messes up the balance, you know, of things. And so things are going real negative. Now, it's interesting that Ahithophel is from his city, Gilah, or however you say it, Gilo, or... What's interesting is that Ahithophel is not in Jerusalem like he was for years. He is retired. And what has happened is that Ahithophel is offended at David because his granddaughter is none other than Bathsheba. And so Ahithophel has been waiting for years because he watched David sin against his granddaughter. As his eyes, David seduced his granddaughter and killed his grandson-in-law and shamed the entire family. And so, and Ahithophel's son, his name is Elam, was one of the officers and good friends of Uriah. So Uriah was a friend of the family, so Ahithophel's son Elam and Uriah are officers together in the army, and they're buddies. And so Elam sees Uriah being put to death and goes and tells his dad, Ahithophel, says, you better stop David, he's out of control. I mean, you work with him. He says, he's one of my best buddies. And he married my daughter, Elam's daughter, because they were friends, and he married his daughter, Ahithophel's granddaughter. And so my theory of this, A.W. Pink spells it out very clear. Most people would agree with this. It's not a real difficult theory. That Ahithophel has a root of bitterness and revenge towards David. So he's not in Jerusalem. He's already retired. He's in another city. And he is really mad, waiting his time, biding his time. And revengeful Absalom and him join ranks together, because they both got the same kind of spirit. Now it says when Absalom sent for Ahithophel, verse 12, it was already prearranged. They already knew what was going on. Ahithophel already agreed to the conspiracy before it ever took place. I mean, I'm sure Absalom probably had to get Ahithophel in his back pocket before Absalom would make a move. He needed a mighty man like this on his side, or I don't think it would work. So the conspiracy is growing in number because God has sovereignly raised up Absalom. He's going to judge Absalom real soon. I mean, within a year, Absalom's going to be gone. But he doesn't know that. He's completely misinterpreting what's going on. Okay, B, David escapes from Jerusalem. Now a messenger came to David, saying, "The hearts of the men of Israel are with Absalom." Again, David's about 60 to 62. He only lives to be 70. And his son is approximately 30. David is known for, since he was about 38, so let's call him 40. Now he's 60. He's known for 20 years the sword was going to, there would be a great thing emerge in his family. He didn't know for sure what it was, because he heard this word when he's about 40. Now he's about 60. Now he's already had the death of Amnon. He's had the rape of his daughter Tamar, and probably smaller level strife and breakups in his family that we can't know about. I mean, that are not recorded. The sword has not departed from his house. But he's still probably waiting for the big one, you know, like there's probably something bigger coming. 20 years. I mean, doesn't that make you want to pull your hair out? I'm like, Lord, do it. Let's get it over with. I mean, it's like when Samuel the prophet called David out and visited him and laid his hands on him, he was 17. He doesn't become king of Israel for 20 years. Now he's 38 a year later. He commits this hideous sin. Now he has 20 years to wait for the judgment to really be fully worked out. So he's got this in his heart the whole time. So he's carrying these prophetic words that are long time in duration. Those things, you know, are make the story more powerful, the time frame, because you kind of assume it's like right away, but it's not. He's waiting, looking. Even the knowledge of it is disciplining his heart. I mean, the knowledge of it is producing meekness in him, as far as I can understand. So they come and they say, the men of Israel is Absalom. David goes, I knew it. I knew it was Absalom. He's my favorite. I mean, he really was David's favorite son. David was swayed by Absalom just like the nation was. Never says it, but the way he carries on is unparalleled to any of his other children. And he's saying, oh, I can't believe not Absalom. I knew it. I saw him kissing people's hands on the chariots, the horses. I knew he was angry at his brother, you know, Amnon, when he killed him. And so David knows it's only a matter of time that he's going to come after David. He wants to kill his father David. So David has to deal with this. Absalom is not mad at him. Absalom wants to murder him. He's thinking, and the whole nation knows his son wants to kill him. And so David is, you know, I've heard people do this, having studied this book just a little bit over the years, and someone says, yeah, you shall be as unto David. And I go, duck. You know, and the young man stands up and puts his chest out. I go, duck. I go, ask what do you mean? Like unto David. Get the whole message. Don't just run with that and put it on your refrigerator, you know, and tape it up there. Find out what the prophecy means. Anyway, verse 14. I mean, David had it hard. I mean, he really did. I mean, his heart life was... Can you imagine your son? The whole nation knows your son's trying to murder you, and he brings the whole nation to attack you. So David said to all of his servants who were with him, verse 14 of Jerusalem, arise and let us flee, or we shall not escape from Absalom. Make haste to depart, lest he overtake us suddenly and bring disaster upon us and strike the city with the edge of the sword. One thing I love is David's concerned about the city. The one thing Absalom isn't concerned about. David says, I don't want innocent people in the city getting hurt. I mean, there's still the shepherding heart working. He knows that Absalom's going to try to take his life, but he goes, hey, let's get out of the city. Let's people in the city get innocently hurt in the crossfire. So I think that's a wonderful thing about David. But this phrase, arise and let us flee, sure, it's to be saved from Absalom. But David had, I mean, obviously, this sounds like an understatement. It is a serious clout in Jerusalem. I mean, he could have marshaled an attack against Absalom, no problem. David had so much power and clout socially in the nation. But David is fleeing without a fight, no resistance. He just gets up and goes. He knows what's going on. He knows chapter 12, verse 10 to 12. He knows what's taking place, that God's discipline and judgment is on him. That's why he doesn't marshal an army to fight Absalom right now. He just leaves the city. David's the one who killed the lion and the bear. He's the one that killed Goliath. He's the one that waited out the Saul troubles. He's the one that killed the Philistines. He's not afraid of Absalom. That's not what's happening. He knows what's going on. He knows what's going on. You can read it. Maybe if we have time, we will. Psalm 42 and 43 tell us what's going on in David's heart in this time. Psalm 42 and 43, it's written in the time where Absalom was pursuing David. He was. When you read Psalm 42 and 43, you know David says, I know I will win. My enemy will be crushed. God will prevail. He knows he's going to win in the end. But he doesn't want to fight back. I think he loves his son, but he knows he's under divine discipline too. He's saying, Lord, have your way in my life. That's what's the cry of Psalm 42, 43. So you want to read Psalm 42 and 43 in conjunction with this to see what's in his heart, why he's fleeing without any resistance whatsoever. Because there is a time to resist. There really is a time to resist, but this is a time where he says, it's clear to me what's going on. He could see God's hand, not just Absalom's rebellion. I mean, blessed is the man or woman that can see the hand of God, not just the rebellion of the person in front of them or their weakness or immaturity. He said, something bigger than a rebellious son is in front of me. It's the hand of God disciplining and training me and training the nation, because the nation is watching this too. Solomon is watching this. All the king's court is watching this. So it's not like just David is the only one learning. The entire nation is learning. And here it is 3,000 years later, and we're learning from it. All of history has learned through this event. So it was bigger than just David's life. So he doesn't pursue. He says, I'm gonna take the Hebron revolt, and I'm just going to, this rebellion coming out of Hebron from Absalom, I'm going to endure it. Verse 15. The king's servant said to the king, we are your servants, ready to do whatever my lord the king commands. Verse 16, then the king went out of his household after him, but the king left the ten women, concubines, which are legal wives, to keep the house. Now David is being led by the invisible hand of God, because it's going to fulfill the word of God from chapter 12, verse 10 to 12. The word of God is going to be fulfilled, that his own wives would be violated in front of all of Israel because of what he did to Bathsheba. He said, you did it in secret in chapter 12. Nathan the prophet said, but your wives will be violated before the entire nation. And what David didn't know is that his own son would be the one doing it. And so David is thinking of the house. He's not remembering the full sense of the word of it. He's probably not grasping the full scope of the word. Or maybe he really understands it and he leaves them there. I don't know. But he leaves them there to keep the house. The king went out with all the people after them, and stopped at the outskirts of the town, of the outskirts of Jerusalem. He actually went to the Mount of Olives, to the Mount of Olives. Then all the servants passed before him, all the bodyguard did, the 600 bodyguard of David who had followed him clear back from Gath. Now Gath, remember, was when he was Ziklag, and Gath back in this, you know, back when David was in his 20s. These 600 men have followed him from the early days. David is now 60. They've been with him since he was in his 20s. Because David was finished with Gath, remember, when he became, because he became king at age 30 over Hebron only. So in his 20s is when he was with Gath. So they've been with him over 30 years. So this bodyguard has. So I like them. They're loyal in the difficult seasons, and with Saul in the wilderness, David at Hebron, David at Jerusalem, now David in the wilderness. They're in for the long haul. I appreciate their ability to go through the seasons, the hard, and the Lord will raise up people like that. In some ways, the Lord is David. In some ways, every one of you are David. And so, you know, because David's a picture of the Lord, but he's a picture of a person who's trying to obey God, who falls short, and the Lord trains. And so the Lord, even in times of discipline, David has more friends than he knows. Because when the storms gather, it seems like nobody is for him. But David has these interventions. A number of people stood loyal to him, but he probably didn't feel like any of that when he was on the run. Because the enemy seems so big when we're in that season, and our friends and allies seem so small. But it's not really true. David has people with him. You read the Psalms at this time, it seems like everybody is forsaking him, but it's not exactly true. There were people that were loyal with him through all the seasons. Then David said to Ittai the Gittite, how would you like to be called Ittai the Gittite? why are you also going with us? Return and remain with the king, for you are a foreigner and an exile from your own place. In fact, you came only yesterday. Why should you wander up and down with us today since I go and I don't know where I'm going? Return and take your brethren back. Mercy and truth be with you. So David has this guy, Ittai, who becomes a very important person to him a little bit later in the battle. He says, you don't need to hassle this with me. David's got people coming from everywhere. He says, we'll stand with you. He says, hey, I appreciate it. But he goes, you haven't been with me that long to where you should be weathering these storms out here with me. And I like David's sensitivity to him. He says, mercy and peace. Just go back. Well, Ittai wants to stand with David. He ends up leading one-third of the army, with Abishai and Joab leading the other, each having one-third in the attack in a few chapters later. So the Lord's showing that he does have people loyal to David in this season. He's showing that David is not completely abandoned. Although David felt completely abandoned, because you can read that in Psalm 41. If you want to read three psalms also about David's this time of Absalom, these are the psalms that talk about his betrayal against David. Psalm 41, Psalm 55, and Psalm 39. 41, 55, and 39. Those are three other psalms about this season. Psalm 55, if we have a chance, I want to look at that one a little bit later. That's when he talks about the people who worshiped God with him, who took sweet counsel and fellowship together with him, have lifted up their heel to strike him. You know, like the horse would strike, a person. I mean, being struck by the heel of the horse, it means like almost utterly ruined. He's thinking of Absalom and Ahithophel in Psalm 55 when he's writing this. And boy, those, if you feel betrayed by your friends, even one friend, read Psalm 55, Psalm 41, and then some Psalm 39, and you will. Those are the ones where he expresses his grief over betrayal of these key people in his cabinet against him. Okay, so Ittai says, as the Lord lives and as my Lord the King lives, surely whatever place my Lord the King shall be, whether in death or life, even there your servant will be. He goes, I'm not a fair weather friend. He goes, I don't care if you're a cave again. He goes, I'm with you to the end. I know what's going on. I see the purpose of God. And the Lord, I believe, will raise up people around people's lives. I think all of us have the chance, if we serve people and give ourselves to, the Lord will see to it that there's that one, you know, Ittai. Well, there's a number of them, actually, in David's life. Of course, he had such, you know, a platform, and he was serving so many years and winning the battles of Israel. So he had, you know, quite a bit of them. But I believe the Lord wants to give all of us these Ittais in our life. But we're not going to get it by being in isolation. David poured his life out for 40 years for the nation. You know, some guy says, I don't have any friends. Well, who have you been serving consistently for 10 years? 10 years? Well, nobody. Well, start today then, and in 10 years you're going to have some 10-year friends. It starts today, you know. It just doesn't happen automatically. And David said to Ittai, go and cross over. Now he's talking about the brook of the Kidron. And Ittai and all of his men, all the little ones with him, crossed over. Here's verse 23 is important. All the country wept with a loud voice. The whole country is divided. They're going, wait a second. Do we choose Absalom or do we choose David? And they said, half of our friends are going with Absalom. The other half are going with David. We've lost. Our whole communities are disrupted. The sin of David and Bathsheba has allowed an adversary to raise up, and the adversary has split the nation right down the middle. Now, I mean, not technically 50-50, but relationships are all torn everywhere. One gang is saying, wait a second. David is the anointed of God. What are we doing? And the other one says, yeah, but he sinned and deserves it. And there's all kinds of turmoil everywhere. And so the whole nation is weeping when this division hits. And all the people crossed over the brook Kidron, which is real close to Jerusalem. I mean, it's on the Mount of Olives. It's right next to it. I mean, it's like a mile away. It's close. There's just this little brook they all cross over. So they're still very close to the city at this time. David sends Zadok back with the ark. Verse 24, there was Zadok also, and all the Levites from Jerusalem are with David. I mean, I like that. They all said, hey, we're with you. And so, because they saw David going in before the Lord, before the ark, worshiping and writing the Psalms and singing, they said, we know what the score is. We have seen what's in your heart. We're still with you. Because Absalom had such a wicked heart, but the Levites saw David worshiping at the house of God regularly. So I think that's why they're there. And Zadok is bearing the Ark of the Covenant, because the Ark of the Covenant is what they sometimes would bring into battle, and it would bring the presence of God. And the Ark of the Covenant would give, I mean, when they brought the Ark of the Covenant, David's people would go, yay, God is with us. Absalom's people would go, oh no, the Ark is gone, it's with David. And David looks at this, and he looks him right in the face, he says, in verse 25, he says, the king said to Zadok, bring the Ark back. He says, I don't want the Ark of the Covenant. He goes, I don't want to pretend that God is on my side. He's the one doing this to me. He goes, bring the Ark back. And Zadok goes, really? He goes, hey, I'm in God's hands. I know what's happening. Again, you read Psalm 42 and 43. He knew he would win. He says, I don't want the Ark. I don't want to make some big show about this. He goes, bring the Ark back. Verse 25, if I find favor in the eyes of the Lord, he will bring me back. He will show me both it, the Ark, and his dwelling place. But if God says, I don't have delight in you anymore, in other words, I'm not going to keep you in your position as king, here I am. Let God do to me as seems good to him. He made me run around for 10 years around the wilderness, and then he made me king, and that's not even really what I wanted, because remember back in chapter 2 Samuel chapter 2, verse 1, when Saul died, David said, where do I go up? Do I take the whole nation or a little bit? And God said, just a little bit, just Judah right now. So David never really wanted to be king. David wanted to give himself to God. I like that about David. He said, hey, my thing isn't to keep being king. My thing is to know God, to feel his love and to love him and to obey him. And he says, and so if the Lord has pleasure in me being king, fine. When he says, if I have no delight in you, what he means is in you being king. Because he knew God delighted in him as a person. But he didn't know if God still wanted to be king. He knew his son Solomon would be king. Because in 1 Chronicles chapter 22, verse 9, remember what Chronicles is? That's right. That's the little short version. It's the little added. 1 Chronicles 22, 9 tells us this. Even before Solomon was born, way back when Absalom was just a little guy, and Amnon was just a little guy, and Tamar was a little gal, and they're all young little family. Absalom's right when he was being born. God spoke to him. He says, this son will be the heir. So David knew his family line would not be broken. He knew that there wasn't going to be, you know, another dynasty started like with a lot of the other kings of Israel. Another group would kick them out and that would be the end of their dynasty. He knew that Solomon would be king. He knew it wouldn't be Absalom. He knew it wouldn't be Amnon. He knew it wouldn't be the second son, who I can't remember his name, you never hear of, but he's in there. He's only mentioned once. He must have died in his youth or something. David knew it wouldn't be Adonijah, who tried to be king and a little bit older than Absalom, a little bit older than Solomon at the very end of David's life. He knew it would be Solomon the whole time. So that's what some of David's suspicion when he looked around at his sons over the years. He goes, I know you four aren't going to be kings. The four oldest, he says, I know Absalom. I think Absalom was seventh or eighth or something like that. Probably sixth, something like that, or seventh or eighth, something like that. Solomon, how old is Solomon? Let me think for a second. Solomon is, let me see, David is 60. Okay, David is 70 when Solomon's 30. Good, he's 20 then. Thank you. Solomon is about 20. I never was good at geography. I never could figure that stuff out. Okay. What's Solomon doing? One verse talks about the young man Solomon is inexperienced. That's just the verse I'm thinking of. He's inexperienced in his youth. That's one comment they make in Chronicles about Solomon at this time. I'm not sure what he's doing, to be honest. You know, there you go. But I know he's the king. He's going to be king in 10 years, that's for sure. And David knows it because David knew it from his birth, from Solomon's birth. So that puts a little different swirl on David's perspective here. The king said to Zadok the priest, are you not a seer? Then return to the city in peace with your two sons. Now these two sons are going to be spies for David. Okay, verse 28. Then, see, I will wait in the plains of the wilderness until word comes from you to inform me. David totally trusted Zadok, Abathar, and his sons. Because, you know, David, if they join the conspiracy, they can give David wrong information. He can go right, and Absalom will be there instead of left. But he trusts them. However, he does know the outcome. He really does. He knows Solomon will win, be king. He knows that he will live. And he knows what he's hoping is that Absalom will not be killed, but Absalom will be restrained, you know, and then David won't let him in the court again, but he wants him to live and he wants to be with him. He'll probably, you know, exile him somewhere and see him when he wants to, but he's hoping Absalom actually won't be killed. But he knows Absalom's not going to be king, he's sure of that. But if he knew Absalom's heart, he could probably have figured it out that a rebellious, revengeful person was never going to let Solomon be king. So he could have added up and say, well, probably Solomon won't make it through all this. I mean, Absalom won't make it through all this. Therefore, verse 29, Zadok and Abiathar carried the ark of God back to Jerusalem. They remained there. I love the fact he sent the ark back. He said, I know what's going on. The Lord's dealing with me, so I don't want the ark here. I don't want to endanger the ark and, you know, something happened to it or pretend like God isn't the one doing this to me. Okay, E, David goes up to the Mount of Olives, David, which is right next to Jerusalem. David went up by the ascent of the Mount of Olives and wept as he went. There's godly sorrow. David sees the whole nation weeping. He sees the whole nation divided. He knows that people are going to be killed soon. And he knows that he was the fruit of it. I think that his weeping is not like, oh, I can't be king, like most men would weep. He's weeping. He said, I did this. I did this whole thing. The whole nation is weeping. Men are going to be dead. You know, children are going to lose their fathers. The Philistines are, you know, round about. They don't need to lose, you know, 50,000 soldiers, which is about what they lose in this skirmish here that's coming ahead. It's a horrible, horrible emotional, spiritual, economic, it's a disaster in every way for the nation. So he's going up and David's figuring out what's going on. He's weeping. His head was covered. He went barefoot, which is all a sign of humility and repentance. He's going head covered and barefoot. The people went up with him, covered their heads, and they were all weeping as they went up. It's the picture of the humble, repentant man here. He's not, you know, praying, oh God, please make me king. He's saying, oh God, please make this discipline as short as possible, as painless as possible. Then someone told David, Ahithophel is among the conspirators with Absalom. He goes, oh, I knew it. I knew it. He's been mad at me for 20 years. I knew when he resigned a few years ago and left Jerusalem to go to his own city that I knew it was anger. He said it wasn't, but I knew it was. And David said, oh Lord, I pray, turn the counsel of Ahithophel into foolishness. David is more fearful of Ahithophel's counsel than he is Absalom's rage. He says, I don't want Ahithophel on his side. He goes, oh God, this scares me. Because he knew that his counsel was like the counsel of God. It's what it says, I think, in chapter 16, verse 23. So David is interceding. And now you go back to Psalm 55, the one where he talks about how his sweet counselor betrayed him, the one that he ate bread with and had sweet fellowship with. He's talking about Ahithophel as well as Absalom, but more Ahithophel. And so in the beginning of Psalm 55, the first three verses, he's praying, oh God, deliver me. And he's praying, help me. He's praying this prayer when he says, I pray, turn the counsel. Psalm 55, 1-3 elaborates on this prayer because it was written at this exact time. Just for those of you that don't know the story, in chapter 17, verse 14, it does work. The prayer is answered. The intercession is turned. Ahithophel's counsel is stopped. Now it happened. David and Hushai's plan. Now it happened when David had gone to the top of the mountain. He's still at the Mount of Olives. He's still real close. He's still only a mile away from Jerusalem, from the city, from the palace, or 2 miles. You know, it's real, just over the brook Kidron there, by the Mount of Olives. And so he'd come to the top of the mountain. David had come to the top of the mountain where he'd worshiped God. I like what A.W. Pink says here. He goes, weeping and worship do go together. Sometimes when we're weeping, we can't worship because our heart is so broken. But a broken heart for sin and for the negative consequences and worship can go hand in hand. So David worships here at the most desperate time in his life. This is more desperate than the Thou Art the Man 20 years earlier. This is more desperate. I mean, the nation is being broken. His son is trying to murder him. He knows people are going to get killed. It's, again, it's very costly economically. Everything is a disaster. On every front, it's a disaster. There Hushai, the Archite, came to meet him with his robe torn with dust on his head. Hushai, which is called David's friend. He was also a counselor like Ahithophel. These were the two great counselors in Israel, although Ahithophel was even more famous than Hushai was. But Hushai was like those. Those were the two guys that had the counsel like the counsel of God. He says, I'm with you. He comes with the humility, torn robe, dust on his head. He goes, I'm identifying with you right here. David said to him, if you will go with me, then you will become a burden to me. He says, then I have to feed you and your family and everyone else. Because when the man came, he had to bring the whole group with him. You know, he couldn't leave the family, you know, back at home. And David says, because we find out later, there's thousands that have gathered with David at the end. Thousands, because he puts captains over thousands and hundreds when it's time to attack. So it's growing bigger and bigger and bigger. And he needs supplies and food. You know, they're living a little bit off the land, but they have a tremendous financial need right here at this time as well. He goes, you'll be a burden to me, Hushai. He goes, here's what I want. If you'll return to the city and go join Absalom. It's in essence what he's telling him. And Hushai is going, okay. He goes, Absalom will never believe it because Hushai was called David's friend. And even Absalom says, wait, aren't you my dad's best friend? And Hushai tricks Absalom because he appeals to his pride. He says, go back to the city and say to Absalom, I will be your servant, O king, as I was your father's servant. So I will now be your servant. Then you may defeat the counsel of Ahithophel for me. Now, A.W. Pink doesn't like this. He thinks that that David is conniving. Other commentators see it different because throughout the Bible, deceit is always used in warfare. You don't go, you know, to the enemy that's trying to blow your nation up and tell them your plans. You know, they say, hey, what are you doing? You tell them opposite. You know, the whole point of warfare and tactics is to trick and deceive and make them think one thing so you'll do another thing. And I think what he's doing is okay. A.W. Pink doesn't agree with me because the Lord honors this and the Lord answers it and with the favor of God on the whole thing. And it's a full-scale civil war. Though God has raised up Absalom, Absalom is still revolting against the king. It's still illegal, and God still judges Absalom with death. Because God did not make Absalom have the rage and rebellion. God just directed it towards David. But Absalom is still responsible for his rage and rebellion before God. God never made Judas betray Jesus. He just found a betraying heart, and put him in the circle. And so God is not responsible for Judas's betrayal, nor is he responsible for Absalom's rage and rebellion. God looked across and said, I need a man with rage and rebellion in his heart who by his own will chooses it, and I want to put him in the right position and direct him towards David. So God is always blameless with Absalom's rage. And so God disciplines Absalom at the end, obviously, with premature death. He goes, go defeat the counsel of Ahithophel for me. And you do not have Zadok and Abiathar the priest with you. Therefore, it will be that whatever you hear from the king's house, he should say from that little brat's house, but he calls his son the king. I mean, what? Like, David, dial down, the king's house. The guy's been in office 3 weeks, you know. And he says, whatever you find out, he goes, go whisper to Zadok and Abiathar, because those are the priests who are taking care of the ark. He says, Hushai, here you are in the cabinet meeting. You find out the inside stuff. You go tell Zadok and Abiathar, who were at the temple, the tabernacle of David. They will tell their sons, and their sons will run at night and come tell me. That's the setup. Now remember, if any of these guys betray David, David's in trouble, humanly speaking. But David trusts these guys. I mean, there's nothing like walking together through thick and thin for 30 years. Because when the hour of crisis comes, they're there together. He says, I want you to be my spy. And so he talks about the two sons in verse 36. Verse 37, so Hushai, David's friend, went into the city, and Absalom came into Jerusalem. D, David's flight continues. David's flight continues. Roman numeral 2. Okay, 16 verse 1. When David was a little past the top of the mountain, he's still in the same place, then Ziba, the servant of Mephibosheth, comes and lies to him. He gives him a whole bunch of stuff in verse chapter 16, verse 1. Gives him all these supplies, 200 loaves of bread, 100 clusters of raisin, 100 summer fruits, a skin of wine. He comes there and gives him this stuff, and he lies to him, which I'm going to skip some of this for time's sake. He lies to him. He says, Mephibosheth has joined Absalom, but I love you. And it's a total lie, and it gets reconciled later. Because Ziba is Absalom's, you know, servant. And if you know Mephibosheth from 2 Samuel 9, he's crippled. He can't go join David. But when David comes back some months later, when the whole thing is done, I guess it's months, I don't really know, it never says, but you assume this thing takes time to move these kind of people from one end of the country to the other and all this stuff. But it says that he let his mustache grow out, didn't wash his feet, didn't wash his hair, you know, all these kind of things in mourning over David. So Ziba goes and lies and says, can I have his portion? And so David says, yeah, since you're loyal to me and he's betrayed me, you can have all of his land and everything. And so he's lying there, and that's pretty bad. Okay, so we're going to skip that part. Okay, B, Shimei curses David. So now, Ziba and Shimei are the two guys that David deals with later. That's why they're highlighted here. One of them lied to David, Ziba, and one of them cursed David, Shimei. And so later on, when David becomes king in Jerusalem, he deals with these two guys again. So we're looking at David's heart. We're seeing, you know, how he does things in the middle of this crisis. That's why these are highlighted, because it's actually revealing more about David than it is about them. Okay, so the king came to this place, and Shimei comes out there, and he's cursing him continually as he came. So they're actually still just in a small village right by the Mount of Olives. They're still only a mile or two from Jerusalem. They haven't fled yet. And Shimei comes and he starts cursing him. And verse 6, he threw stones at David and all the servants of the king. And all the people and all the mighty men were on his right side and his left. So he's across from the way. You'd think that this Shimei guy would have, you know, seen all the mighty men there and taken off. But he's just filled with bitterness. Shimei said thus when he cursed, come out, you bloodthirsty man, you rogue. Verse 8, the Lord has brought upon you all the blood of the house of Saul. That's not true. This isn't related to the blood of the house of Saul. David didn't kill Saul. David saved Saul's life. David spared Saul in 1 Samuel 24 and 26. So Shimei has the boldness to interpret how this judgment is on David. He completely misinterprets it. He says, the Lord has brought upon you the blood of the house of Saul in whose place you have reigned. He says, and the Lord has delivered the kingdom into the hand of Absalom your son. That's another misinterpretation. Absalom only has it for a couple weeks or a couple months, however long. So now you're caught in your own evil because you're bloodthirsty. Now that's true. He is caught in his evil, but it was Uriah's blood that he took. So this Shimei guy has it all backwards. He's assuming that he has the ability to interpret this thing in a right way. Verse 9. So Abishai, the son of Zerah, said to the king, please, why should this dead dog curse my lord the king? Please let me go over and take his head off. Because these are treasonous words. These are treasonous words that are going on. When he says, you bloodthirsty, you curse, you this, you that, and all this other stuff, that is saying, like, I'm against you. I'll be for anybody that raises up against you. That's treason. This is like Luke 9:54, when the sons of thunder said, you know, let fire fall on them and consume them. You know, the sons of thunder, which is John and James. Now, it's interesting that John became the beloved. He's the one that laid his head on the Lord's chest, but he was a thunderous guy. I mean, he was a fireball at the end, but he became the apostle love at the end. So those fireballs can be transformed, but Abishai isn't. Like in Luke 9:54, it says, let fire come down, John said to Jesus. And Jesus said, you don't know what spirit you're of. And that's the same thing that Abishai doesn't know what spirit he's of. But the king said, what have I to do with you, you sons of Zerah? He says, let him curse, because the Lord has said to him, curse David. Who then shall say, why have you done so? He says, maybe God's told him to curse me. He says, David said to Abishai and all of his servants, see how my son who came from my own body seeks my life? How much more may this Benjaminite do it? Let him alone, let him curse, for so the Lord has ordered him to curse me. It may be the Lord will look on my affliction, and that the Lord will repay me with the good for this cursing on this day. So David can see the hand of God like few people could see that hand of God in his negative circumstances. I mean, what a blessing. All the other guys, all they could see was Shimei, but David could see God. He says, leave him alone, Abishai, leave him alone. God has told him to curse me. I'm under a discipline of the Lord. I mean, what wisdom to be able to see a person with the wrong spirit against you is actually serving God's purpose for that season, even though this person is lying and cursing you in a way that's not true. I mean, is it possible that the Lord allows people in our lives to discipline our hearts that are completely false in what they're saying about us? David said, let him alone. He goes, I'm not going to attack him. I'm not even going to prove he's wrong. I'm going to take it. I mean, now this is serious. Hello? I mean, this is serious stuff. He says, I know what's happening. He goes, I need this. He goes, I hate it, but I need it. He says, maybe the Lord will look at my humility in this affliction. He will look at me taking this, and he will have mercy upon me. Okay, so as David and his men went along the way, Shimei went along the hillside opposite and cursed as he went, threw stones and kicked up the dust. I mean, he was really mad. Okay, Ahithophel's good advice. Meanwhile, Absalom and all the people, the men of Israel, came to Jerusalem. So the whole gang is gathered. Ahithophel's with him. So these two bitter men, full of rage, they're in Jerusalem. David's still at the Mount of Olives, just a mile or two down the road. Now, understand this. Absalom and Ahithophel were strategically placed into David's earlier life. I mean, when David was 30, Absalom was born. God wanted Absalom in David's family. And God wanted Ahithophel to have this kind of stature for 20 years in David's reign, or 30 years. He wanted this to happen because he wanted David under the pressure. And it takes wisdom to see that God has strategically placed key people in our lives for the right time, and their rage becomes mature at the strategic hour. I mean, it really does. Because God wants our hearts tested or our hearts trained in things. And these people were not accidental. They were placed there by God strategically in David's life. So it was then Hushai, the Archite, David's friend, came to Absalom and said, Hushai said to Absalom, long live the king. And Absalom said, is this your loyalty to your friend? He goes, I thought you and Dad were best friends. He goes, gee whiz, you know. He goes, is this what's going on? And Hushai said to Absalom, no, but whom the Lord and this people and all the men of Israel choose, this I will be, and with him I will remain. This is a total lie. Furthermore, whom shall I serve? Shall I not serve in the presence of his son, as I've sure served in your father's presence? So I will be in yours. Absalom's pride deceives him. He hears this, and Absalom is really, wow, you are a man of discernment. You know, my dad said you had a good word of counsel. Absalom's pride, he's flattered to Absalom, and Absalom, a proud man, can't see through any of it. It's like, yeah, right. And Absalom said to Ahithophel, give your counsel. Here's what Ahithophel says in verse 21 and 22. I'll sum it up. He said, we better take your father right now with 12,000 men. He says, let's go right now. He's only a couple miles away. Let's take 12,000 men and wipe him out before he has a chance to rally the nation and mobilize. Verse 23. Now the advice of Ahithophel, which he gave in those days, was as if one had inquired of the very oracle of God. He was one of the most powerful men in the nation with this incredible track record. Chapter 17, verse 1. Ahithophel said to Absalom, let me choose 12,000. I will rise and pursue David tonight, right now. He's only across the way. We can be there in 3 hours. I can get the men together. We can be there. We can wipe them out. There's not that many yet. Verse 2 at the very end. I will strike the king. He's weak and weary. I'll strike him right now. Okay. D. Hushai's crafty counter advice. I'm kind of speeding up here. Absalom said, now call Hushai and let us hear what he says. Hushai came and said to Absalom, well, he says, Ahithophel isn't giving it to you straight. He says, verse 7, his advice is not good. This one time, it's not good. He goes, if we go strike now, he says, and we fail, the momentum will go against us. He says in verse 8, you know your father. You know his men. They are mighty men. He goes, what if we're not ready? Well, Ahithophel said, yeah, but we're going to take 12,000. I don't care if they got 500. I got 12,000. I don't care if they got 2,000. We'll wipe them out right now. He says, you know your dad and his men. They are enraged in their mind. They're real mad. They're like a bear robbed over cubs. And you know your dad's a man of war. And he's not going to camp with the people. He's going to be snuck out in the side somewhere so we can go attack all the people. Then your dad will know where we are. And they'll have some people hidden. And he'll ambush us. And it'll go terrible. And Absalom goes, really? He goes, yeah, it's going to go horrible. Verse 9, he goes, there'll be a slaughter and everybody will say, Absalom blew it. God's with David. And Absalom starts getting afraid. Verse 10, even who is valiant, whose heart's like the heart of a lion, will melt completely. For all Israel knows your father's a mighty man and those who are with him. Therefore I advise that all of Israel be gathered together first. He goes, let's gather the whole nation. Let's gather. It ended up at the very end of David's life, 1.3 million soldiers. He goes, let's gather hundreds of thousands. And what really Hushai is saying, let's stall for a couple months. Let David rally the nation and mobilize it to come against. He's stalling for time because Ahithophel had the right answer. He had the right counsel. Because David didn't have anybody with him. He had no supplies. Everybody was brokenhearted. And Ahithophel had it right. But God overturned the counsel of Ahithophel. And Hushai, David's friend, tricked him into going with a bad counsel. It says, verse 11, I advise that all of Israel be gathered together from Dan to Beersheba. You know, that's the euphemism from the north to the south, the whole nation, like the sand by the seashore. And you go into battle in person. That's not good. He goes, like your father David. You lead them. You be the courageous leader. Not Ahithophel, because up in earlier, Ahithophel said, I'll lead them. And Hushai says, you don't want Ahithophel to lead. You lead them. You be the... And Absalom goes, yeah. He goes, yeah, you do it. You be the leader, and all the nation will be with you, just like your dad. He's going, yeah, that's right. It says in verse 12, and all of us will gang up on David and wipe him out. Verse 13, and if David withdraws into a city, we'll bring ropes to the city, tear the walls down, because that's what they did when they laid siege against the city. They would take ropes and pull the walls down and go in and kill the city. So Absalom and all the men of Israel said the advice of Hushai is better than the advice of Ahithophel. So here it is right here. Remember when David said, Lord, confuse the counsel of Ahithophel? For the Lord has purpose to defeat the good counsel of Ahithophel to the intent that the Lord might bring disaster on Absalom. See, God did raise up Absalom, but God wanted to destroy Absalom too. God raised him up only for a season to bring discipline to David. This is how God runs nations. God has Ahithophel's and Hushai's and the council of the nations. I mean, it says in Acts 17, he moves the boundary lines of the nations at his pleasure so that men would seek God. I mean, God, he can turn the advice of one to another and have a nation attack. So then Hushai says to Zadok and Abiathar the priests, tell your dad, verse 16, to get out of town quick, speedily, cross the Jordan and get out of here. Get up north at Mahanaim is where he ends up going. Verse 17, Zadok's two sons, they go and they tell David the news. So I'm going to skip a little bit of that. Okay, F, verse 23. Ahithophel commits suicide. So these two sons have went and told David the story. So David takes off north to Mahanaim. Ahithophel saw that his advice, verse 23 of chapter 17, was not followed. He saddled a donkey. He arose, went to his home, his city. He put his house in order. He hanged himself and died. And he was buried in his father's house. This very wise person, some people say, well, his pride was hurt because he knew that Absalom picked Hushai over him. But I think it's more than that. I'm sure that's right. Ahithophel had so much wisdom, he said, I just saw what happened. He says, David just escaped. He said, if David just escaped, God is with David. He goes, I've been with David for 30 years. I know what's happening right now. David has got the... Because he saw Absalom's heart turn towards Hushai. And Ahithophel said, this isn't good. He goes, the Lord is with David. And he said, when they catch me, they will execute me publicly for treason. He said, I'll kill myself. I'll get my house in order. I'll take my own life. I don't want David to look me in the eyes after he did this to my granddaughter, and now he defeats me a second time. I'd rather take my own life. So that's what's happening. I think he sees the inevitability of it. Remember, he's been with David for 30 years. He knows what the score is right now. He knows that David's going to win. That's my theory. I don't think his pride is just injured and he hangs himself. Because he would have probably went out and killed Hushai. He probably would have done instead of hanged himself. It was just pride. G, Absalom establishes his camp in Gilead. David went to Mahanaim, which is across the Jordan. Now he's on the east side of the Jordan, because all this is on the west side, across the Jordan, and it goes up north. Mahanaim is where the headquarters of Abner was, if you remember when they fled from Saul, from Gibeah, where Saul was. Okay, verse 25. We're almost done with the session here. I know you're getting tired here. Absalom made Amasa captain of the army instead of Joab. Of course, Joab's down with David, so he didn't really have the choice. So Amasa, verse 25, is the captain of the army, which is interesting. That's important to note because later, when Joab kills Absalom, and David said, don't kill Absalom, Joab kills him anyway, that David fires Joab and puts Amasa as his captain, his five-star general, or his commander-in-chief over his army, even though he was the rebel guy. David knew he could get the whole nation unified by putting him over the army. Of course, most of you know Joab then goes and kills this guy. Okay, now it happened that when David had come to Mahanaim, that these three guys came and brought him supplies. So there it is again, the goodness of God supplying for David. David's got quite an army. I'll just read one verse of the next session because we're going to, Absalom's death is where we'll start session 16. But look at chapter 18, verse 1. David numbered the people who were with him. He said, captains over thousands and captains over hundreds over them. So there's thousands that are gathering. So when they brought all this cheese and sheep and food and stuff, they brought a lot of it, a tremendous financial provision, which was like David says, oh, look, the Lord provided again because I got this major army. I really don't have the supplies to keep them going. Good.